Welcome to the London Walks podcast, presented by Andy Hallett and Adam Scott Goulding. Ghostly London.
Part 3.
Ambushes terrorists right here, stabs him to death in this very alleyway, and runs for his life. Terrorist is dead before he hits the ground.
Now, oh, you hear the bell? I'll hug you well. You hear the bell? This bell, what is known as Gabriel, that sends a soul to heaven or to hell.
Where the ghosts are, the spirits are, where the mysteries lie.
So here we are, we're outside our number 50 Berkeley Square, which is said to be the most haunted house in London. We didn't phone ahead, we didn't make any appointments, so we're kind of hoping that a ghost materialises. I'm looking up onto the fourth floor here. Can you see anything, Adam?
Not from our standpoint here, no, but as always, we keep an open mind.
Absolutely. So I know it is definitely said to be one of the oldest unaltered buildings in London.
Okay.
And it was built in the late 18th century.
Okay.
So that's interesting in itself.
So while we wait for our apparition, perhaps it'll be like buses and two will come along at once,
absolutely,
I don't know.
Yes.
While we wait for our apparition, here's a short piece that Andy prepared earlier all about the haunting of 50 Berkeley Square.
It's like Blue Peter.
Quite so.
In 1879, the magazine Mayfair published an article stating that the house at 50 Berkeley Square was in great decay, with windows caked and blackened by dust, full of silence and emptiness. Charles Harper published in 1907 Haunted Houses, Tales of the Supernatural, with some account of hereditary curses and family legends, in which he stated the house was the very picture of misery, and every passing stranger stopped the first errand boy and asked various questions, to which the reply was generally, "Haunted House." The first ghostly happenings were reported by Prime Minister George Canning, no less, who claimed to have heard strange noises and experienced psychic phenomena whilst living in the building. In 1872, as a bet, Lord Lyttelton stayed a night in the building's attic. He brought a shotgun with him, and during the night fired at an apparition. In the morning he recovered the cartridges, but could not find any trace of the bullets. Legend varies, but mostly states that the attic room is said to be haunted by the spirit of a young woman who committed suicide there. She purportedly threw herself from the top floor windows and is said to be capable of frightening people to death. The spirit is reported to take the form of a brown mist or an oozing mass, though sometimes described as a figure in white. The reputation of the house was further enhanced by Harper, who also wrote, "It seems that something or other, very terrible indeed, haunts or did haunt a particular room. This unnamed, raw head and bloody bones, or whatever it is, has been sufficiently awful to have caused the death in convulsions of at least two foolhardy persons who have dared to sleep in that chamber." One of these unfortunate souls was a Thomas Warboys, a member of the Athenaeum Club, who, having accepted a dare from friends, attempted to stay the night on the top floor. It was agreed that if he required assistance, he would ring the servant's bell. So saying, he retired to bed. Just after midnight, his friends reported a faint ringing, followed by a ferocious pealing of the bell. Upon arriving, they discovered their friend lying stone dead, as if from a massive shock, his hands in a gripping position, mouth wide open, and eyes bulging as if rigid with fear. More recently, two American sailors on leave, who were a little worse for wear, chanced upon the empty building, and having no other place to spend the night, inadvertently settled down to spend the night in the haunted chamber. In the early hours, they were woken by heavy footsteps coming up the stairs. Suddenly, the door banged open, and a hideous, shapeless, oozing mass began to fill the room. One sailor managed to escape, and on returning with the police, discovered his friend's corpse impaled on the deadly sharp railings outside. His twisted face and bulging eyes, grim testimony to a terror that had provoked him to jump to an untimely macabre death. The building once belonged to a Mr. Dupree, who, it was believed, had locked his lunatic brother in the attic. The captive was so violent he could only be served food through a hole in the door. When he died, his spectre remained to chill the blood of anyone unfortunate enough to chance upon him. Today, Maggs Brothers, a firm of antiquarian book dealers who currently reside at number 50, claim that no such ghost has ever existed in the building, and that it's all hokum. However, recently a bookseller working in the accounts department described seeing a column of brown mist move quickly across the room, while at the same time experiencing the instinctive and deeply disconcerting sense that something unseen was standing watching her.
Well, spooky stuff indeed in 50 Barclay Square. What do you make of it, Andy, this apparition?
Well, I've got to say, actually, out of all of them, I do find this a little bit tricky to take seriously, because unique to this particular ghost, they always seem to describe it as a column of brown mist or some kind of brown mist. It just sounds disgusting, doesn't it? As if some kind of ghost has turned up and delivered some kind of fetid, clinging whiff and then departed and rendered their victims insensible enough for them to throw themselves out the top window. So it's difficult to take a little bit seriously. It's like the kind of Pepe Le Pew of ghosts.
Perhaps so, but macabre stuff, though. The railings from here, we're looking at them, and they are barbarous-looking things.
Well, I was about to say, Adam, I challenge you to stay overnight in this building. having listened to what the description of the place, would you stay there? Do you think you would?
Well, and again, in the spirit of keeping an open mind, no, I would not, because you never know.
What if I put a crash mat outside and kind of covered the railings, and then the walks put on a kind of, you know, you go to a top class restaurant, West End show, stay in this beautiful 18th century building? Still no?
It depends on the show.
This area has changed considerably since King James the First. The chants of actually.
So we're going to stroll over towards... We're right on the cusp of Soho. So we're going to stroll over to Soho. And while we do so, Adam recorded a wonderful piece a little bit earlier about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which is where it was set in Soho.
My own personal favourite horror story is The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, not least because it unites the city of my birth with my beloved adopted hometown. Published in 1886, Robert Louis Stevenson's famous tale of duality, of split personality, is set in part on the mean streets of Soho, but could only have been inspired by the contrasts Stevenson found in the Scottish capital. Stevenson's Edinburgh, as the Edinburgh of today, is split into two greatly contrasting halves, the elegant 18th century New Town and the warren of alleyways and closes of the Old Town around Edinburgh Castle. Further Edinburgh inspiration for Dr. Henry Jekyll can be found in William Brodie, the 18th century deacon and pillar of the community by day and criminal by night, whose popular legend ends with him kicking at the end of a rope on a gallows of his own design. A tale too luridly good to be true, of course, but the legend persists. London, of course, has its own persistent legends, and it is here that Mr. Hyde takes on an afterlife of his own, when he becomes embroiled in the conspiratorial flotsam and jetsam of the Jack the Ripper case. The English actor-manager Richard Mansfield took the dual roles of Jekyll and Hyde in the first successful stage adaptation of Stevenson's tale, and is perhaps instrumental in the work's transition from psychological novella to grand guignol horror. The piece was still playing at the Lyceum in the autumn of 1888. Was Mansfield just that little bit too convincing in the role of the evil Mr. Hyde? Was Mansfield truly Jack the Ripper? Star of stage by evening, serial killer by night. Only the most foaming-at-the-mouth ripperologist would argue the point with any conviction. But there seems no doubt that Stevenson's tale of contrasts, of good and evil cheek by jowl, becomes woven into the fabric of London at this point, in its association with a real-life case set in the East End amid some of the most ferocious poverty in the Empire, right next to the richest square mile on God's green earth.
So we're here now in Soho. I noticed, Adam, that you use a slightly different pronunciation, which is that the correct? I think it is, isn't it?
Wow. Well, some say there's a theory that the pronunciation of Jekyll should be Jekyll, and many Scots pronounce it Jekyll. The thinking, some say, is that Jeek to rhyme with Seek. So then you've got Hyde and see. So, okay, it's not that much of a joke, what he was going for to underpin the duality of the whole
thing. And that's his part of the world. That's where he was from.
His part of the world. Right, Edinburgh, absolutely. Okay. Thinking.
Sir. And it was set here. He's not very particularly specific about where it's set. I know Dr. Lanyon is in Cavendish Square, which is slightly north of here, isn't it?
Well, he provides great contrast there. The respectable doctor living in posh Cavendish Square. Great contrast to the streets of Soho, where Hyde, knocks people into the street and beats them with his stick, and such things just would never happen in Cavendish Square. He's doing there. The West End thing is important in the story as well. I mean, I talked about in the recording about the Jack the Ripper case and the idea that perhaps Richard Mansfield was Jack the Ripper, which he wasn't.
Roaring actor.
Yes, I think it's an interesting idea. There is also the idea that it's not necessarily the actor Richard Mansfield who was Jack the Ripper. Right. It was someone who'd gone to see the play and was so wound up by the bloody spectacle that they came out of the theatre and committed five murders in the East End of London. So the theory is that it may well be the first incidence of what we would now call copycat killing. These terrible cases where someone eventually says, you know, he ran amok with a gun because he'd been watching such and such a movie or listening to such and such a record. Yes. Is this the first instance?
Well, I suppose in that way it's kind of inspired, hasn't it? Some of the kind of superhero genre we have today. Was the Hulk, the kind of split personality type of thing, I suppose, in a way.
I think that's a very good example, actually. It's very much a Jekyll and Hyde thing, the Incredible Hulk. But, of course, it goes into the modern graphic novel as well. I mean, I'm not entirely sure why graphic novels aren't comics. They're very good. But there's The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, where we have Mr. Hyde as one of the team of... Yeah. Victorian superheroes, if you like, trying to save the empire, as not to give too much away, if the listeners haven't read The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, in that alternative universe, Mr. Hyde performs acts of great courage, and that is why Hyde Park is so named. It's named in his honour, which is a lovely idea in a fictional alternative world.
Yeah. And Alan Moore did the graphic novel From Hell, the Jack the Ripper graphic novel.
So it all ties up. Now, in part two, we had a sound effect running through the podcast, and we're going to reveal exactly where in London it was recorded in this episode. So here we go. But first of all, let's just have one more listen. We can now reveal that the sound effect, the spooky sound effect, was recorded in the gents' toilet.
There's the ball.
At the Barbican, yes.
At the Barbican, less.
No less, absolutely. A very cultural experience it was. Now, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can read our blog as well, and you can get links to all of these things through the London Walks website. That's www.walks.com.
And more than anything, come on the walks. Meet us in the flesh.
Well, quite so. In the creeping flesh for Halloween. all the ghost walks are going out on Halloween night, the 31st of October.
Thank you very much.
And see us.
Thank you very much for listening, and enjoy the Festival of the Dead.
London Walks podcast was compiled, produced and presented by Andy Hallett and Adam Scott Goulding. For details of the full programme of London Walks, London's best guided walking tours, go to www.walks.com. The London Walks podcast was an APB production.